Today, as Parliament packs up for the summer after a tumultuous period, The Guardian's parliamentary sketchwriter John Crace takes us through the politicians he thinks have risen to the challenge of a national crisis and those who he says have definitely not.
How has your job changed since the pandemic began? How does one sketch in the time of coronavirus?
It is a difficult balancing line because there is inherently absolutely nothing funny about so many people losing their lives and possibly losing their lives unnecessarily due to government's decision making. But I decided early on that actually the sketch had to be a kind of satirical inquiry into the sort of state of the nation that day. Who was making these decisions? Why were they making these decisions? And to try and find the humour in the hypocrisy and in the lies and in the disjunction between what people were actually saying and what they were. I mean, I can remember Boris's very first press conference he gave in early March.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for coming along, and I'm very glad to be joined this morning by the government.
It's just sort of, it's basically a bit of flu. It's going to be a bit difficult for some people, but some people will be okay.
And let me be absolutely clear that for the overwhelming majority of people who contract the virus, this will be a mild disease.
And Whitty and Valance were there, and they gave a much starker vision.
There will come a point, potentially, and not definitely, but there will come a point, potentially, where the amount of transmission, either in the UK or, equally likely, everywhere in the world, is so great that actually the idea of containing, which is to say essentially getting rid of this virus completely, ceases to make sense.
And it was almost as though Boris couldn't bear to end on a sort of bleak note. So he said in the end, I went visiting a coronavirus ward the other day and I shook hands with all of them.
I shook hands with everybody, you'll be pleased to know, and I continue to shake hands. And
I suddenly thought, and I kind of wrote at the time, the UK has its first super spreader.
I do love John Crace, who spends day after day watching politicians up close, unpicking every mangled sentence, interpreting every bit of awkward body language, and turning it into the parliamentary sketch, which has this amazing ability to both hold politicians to account and make you burst out laughing. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, the politicians who have risen to the challenge of coping with a coronavirus pandemic and those who have not. Before we start, I'm sorry to say that John couldn't quite help himself, and we do have one swear word in here. So you decided, like you say, this isn't a funny story, but your sketch would find humour in the way it was being handled. And in terms of material, you had a fair amount to work with.
Well, I mean, certainly. I mean, because for one thing, we had the daily 5 o'clock Downing Street press conference.
Hello, good afternoon, and welcome to the daily Downing Street press briefing. I'd like to start.
There was almost guaranteed that something would go wrong at some point.
We go to the media now, please. Ian Watson from the BBC. Ian. I think you need to unmute Ian. Can we get Ian's audio? I can kind of lip read, but I think we'll go to Robert Peston of ITV. We'll come back to
next. I turn next to Robert Peston from ITV.
Oh shit. Hello?
Afternoon, Robert.
Then we had the whole sort of social distancing in the House of Commons as well. Rishi Sunak's sort of first budget. They were all close together. And Dominic Raab was coughing away.
And to make sure that time spent off work due to sickness is confidence in the long-term future of our economy, and so do I. Madam Deputy Speaker, to help our businesses lead the next generation of high productivity industries.
And you could see sort of various people around him looking sort of anxious.
Parliament is the assembly of the nation.
And then we had sort of Jacob Rees-Mogg's insistence that everybody should come back to vote.
The first opportunity, in order fully to conduct the essential business not possible from our homes.
He was saying they had to be there in person. So we had this sort of half-mile conga line.
Just behind me is where hundreds of MPs are going to be doing the Mogg conga later. We're going to be queuing. It's going to be like queuing for a ride at Alton Towers. That just turns out to be a bit shit.
This is the queue through Portcullis House. It goes under Westminster Bridge Road, then into Westminster Hall, around Westminster Hall and up into the Chamber. It's got to be about a mile long.
Now back into Westminster Hall, and we're probably going to be here till it's dark.
One vote took 45 minutes. It was a complete shambles.
And in political terms, how you handle the greatest health crisis in a century is clearly a huge challenge. And out of it, we have seen those who have done it well, the political winners, if you like, and those who have done it badly, the political losers. I can imagine a few who you're going to line up on that side of things. But let's just start with those who have succeeded. Give me a politician who you think has given the best account of themselves over the last few months.
I think there have been a number. I mean, I think clearly Keir Starmer at Prime Minister's Question Time has been a clear winner.
Keir Starmer.
Mr. Speaker, the problem with the Prime Minister quoting the 70% of people who are contacted and asked to self-isolate is that's gone down. It was 90% just a few weeks ago, and every week it's gone down.
And I may say to the right honourable gentleman, it is up to him, really, to get behind what the government is doing or not. And
it is perfectly possible to support track and trace and point out the problems. And standing up every week saying it's a stunning success is kidding no one. That isn't giving people confidence in the system. They would like the Prime Minister who stands up and says, there are problems, and this is what I'm going to do about them. Not this rhetoric about stunning success when it's obviously not true.
I mean, literally, to beat Boris at PMQs, all you need to do is to be able to have more than one thought in your head at the same time and to ask a reasonably intelligent question. And Keir has done that repeatedly. And it's reached the point now where sort of Boris sort of says, ooh, you're against me. And you kind of think, Keir, yeah, but I'm the opposition. And Boris just can't handle it. So week after week, Keir has come out looking like the sort of leader that I would certainly feel more comfortable with. If he was in charge during this particular time, I would kind of feel, oh, yes, there's my daddy, if you know what I mean.
There's my daddy?
Yeah. I think it's
sorry. Let's just drill into this thinking. Sorry.
No, let's not.
No, I think we should. I feel like there's a story here. Another podcast. Okay.
Oh no. It's all a bit Oedipal though, isn't it? But you know, like how a time of crisis, you're just sort of longing for somebody to say it's going to be all right, and you know, Keir is that person, really. Whereas whenever Boris opens his mouth, I kind of think, oh, fuck, it's going to be an absolute disaster. You know.
I'm sorry, I'm actually crying.
I mean, I think Nicola Sturgeon's also had played a bit of a blinder because she's, again, sounded much more like a kind of serious leader.
Look, he's taking decisions that he thinks are right for England. He's the Prime Minister of the UK, so when he talks about things like border control, he's talking for the UK. But in terms of easing the lockdown restrictions or changing the message, that is for England. And I have a responsibility to judge
things. You said you don't understand it. I mean, if you, First Minister of Scotland, doesn't understand the new slogan of the UK government, that's pretty serious, isn't it?
But That's why I'm sticking for now with stay at home. My message in Scotland, and my duty is to explain to people in Scotland what I'm asking them to do and why. So except for essential purposes, my message is stay at home.
Part of the SNP's long-term goal is for another Scottish referendum and independence. She has gone out of her way to do things differently to Boris, you know, to be more cautious and to sound more serious.
Is she like the mummy?
I couldn't possibly comment.
Okay, so that's Labour and the SNP. What about the Tories? Are there any politicians in the government who have had a good war, if you like?
Undoubtedly, Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, though even he must be surprised at what's happened, because all he's had to do is just kind of splash out the cash. During his sort of 8 months or so as Chancellor, Sajid never got round to giving a single budget. Basically, Rishi has given about 8 or 9 already at the moment.
Whether it's millions of pounds or billions of pounds, whatever it needs, whatever it costs, we stand behind our NHS. This is a £2 billion cash injection,
a £5 billion,
£7 billion,
a £30
billion,
£175
billion, £1 billion
to guarantee
£600 billion in our future prosperity.
Life might become more challenging for him. They can't keep the furlough scheme going indefinitely. Then there's large-scale unemployment. I wouldn't be surprised if he's beginning to have a few sleepless nights about how it all pans out over the next sort of 6 to 9 months.
I don't think he's having sleepless nights worrying about that. I think he's thinking about how to become Prime Minister. I mean, that might be a bit mean, but a lot of people are talking him up as a potential Prime Minister. I mean, he's got his signature now, hasn't he, on his on all his announcements. You watch him very closely. What do you make of him? What's he like? How does he deliver stuff?
Well, I mean, he delivers it very confidently. And he's also sort of starting to play the media card as well. Michael Gove was seen going off into a Pret at the beginning of last week, not wearing a face mask. So the day next day, Rishi, good Lord, there's a photographer there. And Rishi is dressed like a sort of catalogue model for Freeman's.
Where are you going? Welcome to NG. Hi, Mr. Hitch. Hi. How are you? I'm Rishi. Nice to see you all.
I'm Therese.
So you've all just joined recently, have you?
Yeah.
Looking sort of adorable.
With a mask on.
With a mask on. You know, a nicely ironed mask.
We had to keep going, but as your previous colleagues have done over.
Perfectly offset the colour of his pale blue shirt. You know, I mean.
You think he's been thinking about it?
Oh, yeah. One of the other eccentricities of the whole coronavirus crisis has been Matt Hancock's tie. Which is always the same, which is this increasingly grubby streak of pink polyester. But sort of Rishi, you know, probably has a sort of face mask to sort of colour coordinate with every shirt that it has got in his wardrobe.
It certainly is the case that people have taken a shine to Rishi Sunak in this period. He's seen as having dealt with the crisis well. Are there any others in the Conservative Party who have impressed you?
No. No, I think it's been a disaster for all of them.
Okay, so in which case, what we're basically saying is that the key figures within government have come out of this coronavirus crisis negatively. They have not made their mark. And in fact, the approval rating polls show exactly that. Rishi Sunak has stayed high above everyone else, whilst all the other key cabinet members, although they were very, very popular at the beginning of this, have just gone on a downward trend, including one of the most important, Matt Hancock, the Health Secretary. What have you made of his performance?
Well, I get a bit of flack for this, but I have a sort of residual kind of soft spot for him. I mean, when Boris Johnson got coronavirus, everything felt like it was on a knife edge. Matt Hancock gets coronavirus and nobody really cares or gives him an even break because of it. And I think that, you know, Matt Hancock actually came back from his spell of coronavirus, and he was the first politician to sort of realise that something needed to be done.
There will be problems, like many of those that we've already overcome. After all, building a brand new industry, it's not easy. There will be bumps in the road and criticisms made, and some of them will be justified. And I return from illness more determined than ever to fight this disease.
And he came out with all these bullish things that, you know, the response hadn't been good enough. We were going to get these 100,000 tests.
I am now setting the goal of 100,000 tests per day by the end of this month.
And we were going to get a world-beating app. We were going to have a world-beating track and trace system. Well, most of us would have just settled for one that worked.
Are you a bit concerned that with one third of people who tested positive, for whatever reason, you couldn't get details of recent contacts from?
Well, I would say that I think that the system has worked well, and to get two thirds in the first week of operation, it beat my expectations.
It's all turned to dust in front of him. There was one press conference in particular that I remember, which was a sort of absolute kind of classic, because Downing Street had begun to realise that most of the questions, well, in fact, all of the questions from the media were invariably antagonistic and almost always nothing to do with what the government wanted the message to be that day. So they decided to allow questions from the public. There was one press conference where Matt said, and so now we're going to Martin, who is a vicar from Brighton. Martin, what's on your mind? And Martin Poole, his name was Martin Poole. Martin Poole said,
will the government review all penalty fines imposed on families travelling for childcare purposes during lockdown? Thanks.
Well, thank you, Martin. That's a very good question.
And sort of Matt looked absolutely desperate. He'd been expecting some sort of gentle question that he could say, yes, well, of course, Martin, the government is doing this and everything's going to be great. And he was now having to make stuff up on the spot.
I think, especially coming from a man of the cloth, I think that is a perfectly reasonable to take away that question. I'll have to talk to my Treasury colleagues before I can answer it in full.
Matt started sweating a bit and say, I will have a word with the Chancellor. Yes, this is, of course, a very important issue. And you kind of think, Matt, you've lost the plot.
And make an announcement from this podium. I think we can make that commitment. Thank you, Martin.
that's the minute your career ended.
So that's Matt Hancock. Who are the other big political losers?
Well, I think we have to have a sort of category of absentees, because Boris was accused of running a blokeocracy. And in a way, that's been completely true, because Priti Patel has only been allowed out to do two press conferences, and those were at weekends when not many people were watching. In one of them, she was completely disastrous.
I can report, through the government's ongoing monitoring and testing programme, that as of 9 a.m. today, there have been 974,000 tests carried out across the UK, excluding Northern Ireland.
She announced that there had been something like 300 billion tests done. And I worked out that that meant that everybody in the country had been tested for coronavirus 4,500 times each. She had no grasp of numbers, and it just sort of looked shabby, really. And after that, she was sort of kept locked up.
To protect the NHS and to save lives. Thank you.
Then we got sort of Michael Gove as well, who, again, I mean, with Michael Gove, you can never be too certain. I suspect, because he is sort of the probably the one of the slipperiest, least trustworthy men in sort of the cabinet, that he deliberately tried to make himself absent from as many of these press conferences as possible, because he knew that you could only lose by appearing on them. And he just said, oh no, Matt, you do it again, Matt. You do it awfully well. You know, you go and make a complete fool of yourself. Thank you so much.
So instead, we sort of got this parade of yes men, didn't we? You know, Oliver Dowden, Alok Sharma, Robert Jenrick, who had to come out time and again. But the politician who has probably been most under the spotlight, other than Boris Johnson, is the man who deputised for the Prime Minister when he had COVID-19, Dominic Raab. Do you think he looked prime ministerial in that role?
No. But I think in a way that was deliberate on his part. I think Dominic Raab was very careful to try and not make it look as though he was sort of doing a big power grab. I mean, that did backfire on him big time at one particular press conference.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Downing Street for today's coronavirus press conference.
Because he was sort of saying, oh, yes, this was when Boris was in hospital, remember? And he was saying, oh, yeah, Boris is up in bed. He's, you know, enjoying life. He's running the country.
I can tell you the PM had a comfortable night in hospital and he's in good spirits. He's still in hospital under observation. He's being given regular updates on developments and he continues to lead the government.
I mean, literally an hour after Raab had said that Boris is in charge, he's never felt better, we got an email sent round saying that Boris had been admitted into intensive care unit. And so you kind of really thought, Dominic, do you actually know anything at all? And since then, he sort of rather kind of slid off the scale, really. I think he realised that he wasn't quite cut out for it.
But there's been another huge story in all of this, the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement. Some politicians took the knee. Raab wasn't quite as on it with that one, was he?
No, because he clearly didn't know what it meant.
I've got to say on this taking the knee thing, which I don't know, maybe it's got a broader history, but seems to be taken from the Game of Thrones, feels to me like a symbol of subjugation, subordination, rather than one of liberation and emancipation. But I understand people feel differently about it, so it's a matter of personal choice.
It was sort of staggering, really. And he ended up saying, yeah, I would just kneel for the Queen and the Mrs.
Take the knee for two people, the Queen and the Mrs. when I asked her to marry me.
Didn't quite capture the moment.
No.
Coming up, John Crace turns to who he sees as the biggest political loser of all. So that brings us to the man who Raab stepped in for, the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. He's always portrayed himself as a Churchill-like figure. And like Churchill, he's now had his credentials tested through a crisis. Do you think he's met the challenge?
Boris has probably achieved almost the impossible, and that made us sort of slightly regretful that we don't still have Theresa May as Prime Minister. I mean, almost at every turn, Boris has sort of failed to meet the challenge. A lot of what Boris says doesn't actually make much sense. Go back to work if you can, but best if you stay at home. And you're kind of thinking, at that rate, you know, I'll be spending the rest of my life on the bus between the two.
Yeah, and that was quite widely mocked, including that hilarious and scarily realistic clip doing the rounds on social media by Matt Lucas.
So we are saying, don't go to work, go to work. Don't take public transport, go to work, don't go to work. Stay indoors. If you can work from home, go to work. Don't go to work. Go outside, don't go outside. And then we will or won't do something or other.
Boris doesn't appear to have command of what's going on. Last week, there was a report from the Academy of Medical Scientists, which Keir Starmer quite rightly brought up at Prime Minister's questions.
Yesterday, the government's expert advisory group published a report on the challenges this autumn and winter. They were asked to do so by the government's Office for Science.
which suggested that if the government didn't get its act together, then there could be 120,000 more deaths over the winter.
And it set out strong recommended actions to mitigate the risks. The report was clear, July and August must be a period of intense preparation, i.e. now. Can the Prime Minister make clear that he intends to implement the recommended actions in this report in full and at speed?
Prime Minister, not only are we getting on with implementing the preparations for a potential new spike, but he will know that the government is engaged in record investments in the NHS.
After a few questions that Boris didn't answer, it suddenly dawned on Keir that Boris hadn't actually read the report.
But I have to ask, in light of the last few questions, has the Prime Minister actually read this report?
And said, you haven't read this report, have you? Has he read it? And Boris said,
Prime Minister, I'm of course aware of the report, and we're of course...
I'm aware of that, which is sort of like me being aware of a space-time continuum, but I haven't a clue what it means. Keir sort of ended by saying, look, this is serious. 60,000 people have died already, 120,000 people, more may die, and you aren't on the ball. And Boris just went into one of his pre-prepared gags.
He needs to make up his mind which brief he's going to take today. Because at the moment, Mr. Speaker, it looks he's got more briefs than Calvin Klein. We're getting on.
You've got more briefs than Calvin Klein. And you kind of think, this isn't just, you know, a leader who, a prime minister who's sort of lost the plot. It's one who has sort of managed to insult the whole country in, you know, a 10-second soundbite that he thought was hysterically funny. Part of my reading of Boris was that he never really wanted to be prime minister. What he wanted to do was to become prime minister. The coronavirus, pandemic has, he has been exposed. We had Neil Ferguson, one of the experts on the scientific and advisory group for emergencies, concluding that Boris delaying lockdown by a week cost 20,000 lives. That's a huge amount of people to have died.
You began by telling us that it's difficult to get the balance right in these times. These times are not funny, they're incredibly sad, but it's your job as a sketchwriter to offer people humour in politics. How have you found walking that tightrope?
It's been tough. Satire was always meant to be, not just about entertainment and humour, though that's some of its tools. It's about holding truth to power. And that's where I really see my role as a sketch writer in these times. We constantly talking ourselves up as sort of Britain as this sort of the greatest country on earth. And yet we have the country with the largest number of deaths. And, sooner or later, someone is going to have to explain that, why this has actually happened, why it's been allowed to happen. We are the laughing stock of most other countries. We become, the benchmark of how not to handle a crisis for the rest of the world.
And you've been watching British politics closely for a long time through a number of tumultuous political periods. As you mentioned, just before this, you were doing Brexit. And even before that, it seems a long way away now, but even the coalition government was quite a tumultuous period at times. How different does this period feel to you? And have you learned anything new about politics in this time?
Before I started sketching, have I always been sceptical about politicians? Yes. But I always felt that there was some kind of plan to it, to what was going on. And I suppose what the coronavirus has illustrated to me is literally that governments They did it with Brexit and they're now doing it with coronavirus, is that they're making up policy on the hoof. They literally don't know what they're doing from one day to the next. And that is, I think, genuinely scary. And I think a lot of, you know, it's not just me that's had that sort of insight. I think a lot of the country have come to sort of feel that as well. And that's why I think the sort of the country feels so unsafe at the moment. They don't feel as if there are any leaders who are worth the name.
John Crace, thank you so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure, as ever.
That was John Crace. Do go to theguardian.com to read all his brilliant sketches. He also has a number of books that collate his writing. Most recently, Decline and Fail, Read in Case of Political Apocalypse. Thank you for all your lovely reviews for Today in Focus. I particularly appreciated Flo Gilly, who wanted to reassure us that they accidentally clicked the wrong star rating on their phone and they do love us, really. That is so sweet. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.